Next case is Medical Diagnostic Labs versus Healthcare Service Corporation, 1761-89.
May it please the Court, Mark Spencer. I represent the plaintiff appellant, Medical Diagnostic Laboratories. I'll try to be brief in the appeal, Your Honors. This is a ruling on a motion to dismiss a complaint. It's a fairly simple case, I think. If I was going to capsulize what I think the fundamental error is in this case, is that the district court seemed to treat this as a claim by my client for being excluded from the Blue Cross network. We've made it clear, I think, that is not the claim that MDL is trying to assert. One point that I do want to make clear is and we try to make this clear in footnote 3 of our brief, is why we decided to appeal instead of amend. We didn't make a blanket request to amend below. Obviously, any time a complaint's dismissed or when you're confronted with a motion to dismiss, if there's something that's curable, you want to be able to cure it by amendment. We see a difference between a curable situation where a district court says, for example, you failed to plead scienter and a fraud claim with enough specificity, so we're going to give you another chance to plead. That's a curable situation. In this situation, as we see it, this was a rejection of the theories that we asserted. And if you look, Judge DiGiusti, it looks to me like he understood our theory. He gave a set of bullet points on pages 5 and 6 of his order. He understood what we were trying to assert. He just rejected the legal theories.
But I thought on appeal you were saying you'd like the opportunity now to amend. I misunderstand you?
No. If the court, we have never had, as of yet, a curable defect identified. All we have that we've received is a rejection of the two legal theories that we tried to assert. If you see something that you think can be cured, obviously, we'd like to know.
The curing is in the eye of the beholder, and that's you. Do you have facts that would establish your claim in a way different than the district judge saw?
I would answer it this way. From our perspective, they're in the complaint. That's why we elected to stand on it, and that's why we're appealing.
So you're telling me that there are no new facts that you could allege that would fill the holes that the district judge says are vacant?
Yes, that's the way we see it, and that's why we decided to stand on the pleading. We may be wrong. There may be something that somebody else sees, but we think that we've pled the facts, and we don't.
But I guess my point is that only you know what unpled facts there are.
Sure.
We don't. And so you're not going to hear about that from us.
Sure. And you know, I've seen this happen before. I had this happen last year where a plaintiff tried to plead a claim and it was legally invalid and they were given three opportunities to replead it and they couldn't plead a claim. So we didn't see any point. We respect Judge DiGiusti's
rejection. In other words, the only facts you have on the defamation is that somehow your product was impugned because Blue Cross said these other providers could do the same thing you do. That's your definition,
yes.
Right?
Yes. That's the statement.
You have no other facts other than that.
No, we identify
either defamation or it's not.
Yes,
right?
that's exactly
right.
If it
is defamation, it's a reverse. If it's not defamation, it's an affirmative.
That's right. That's correct.
Well, I appreciate that. It's helpful.
Okay. I'll move on to our defamation claim.
Well,
I'm sorry.
I was just going to ask you, how is that defamatory?
Well, if you read the legal definition of defamatory, and we've cited those on pages 27 and 28 of our briefs. You know, I was thinking about this as I was preparing. When the 1960s came along and New York Times and Actual Malice came along, I think people sort of tend to think of defamatory statements as being malicious statements, rude statements.
I'm not going to think that. I realize that's not the case. I just, on its face, how is that defamatory?
Well, if you read the elements, of defamation under Oklahoma statutory and case law. It's things that injure a person in his occupation. Our occupation is marketing a patented test. When somebody says that that test is no better than tests that are offered by people who, according to the complaint, do not offer that kind of testing, it tends to lower my client, the company, and its occupation.
The way I think she asked you how it was defamation on its face, and I guess I want to clarify, this isn't a defamation per se case, right? I mean, it's per quo.
Well,
you're not suggesting on its face. I thought you were suggesting per quo. Essentially, it could be an innocuous statement that could cause these damages.
My understanding is, at common law, a statement that would tend to injure someone or say they're unfit in their occupation is per se. But we've analyzed it under a per quo analysis. This company, I'll say it again, they market a patented test that helps women in diagnosing certain types of venereal diseases.
But just before you move on, just help me understand, you're not then making the occupation argument, or you're saying that applies to?
No, I'm saying that applies.
Okay.
Something that tends to injure someone in respect to his office, profession, trade, or business. That comes from the Oklahoma defamation statutes. A statement, if Imadiel invented a pill that cured cancer, and Blue Cross told its doctors that this is nothing special, you shouldn't be prescribing that. You can prescribe other types of medication that's approved in our network that does the exact same thing as what MDL does. That tends to lower MDL in its occupation or its business. It is defamatory. That type of statement is. We think the error that the district court made was on page 9 of the order.
So if there were, under your view, it would be defamatory if there was a television commercial that says, our product does everything theirs does, and theirs may do other things. That's defamatory.
It could be. It would depend on the context of the statement. The context of this statement is we have verified that our in-network laboratories are able to provide the specific services as outlined in your letter. We allege in the complaint, which has to be taken as true, that that's a false statement. They can't verify that because RML and DLO and the other labs, according to the complaint, do not offer those same specific services. It's a false statement, according to the complaint, and the evidence will back that up. So that's our position on the defamation claim.
The argument, as I'm understanding it from the appellee, is that you aren't showing causation. It's basically you're speculating about any causation of damages, lack of referrals.
Okay, well,
can you respond to that?
That's certainly alleged in the complaint. It's alleged in paragraph 60 and
the lack of referrals.
72. And you know, I can tell you anecdotally, this isn't in the record. I have a chart that shows the referrals going like that after the letters are written. So we do have evidence to back it up, but we don't have to present that evidence. All we have to do is make the allegation, and then we can flesh our claim out in discovery on summary judgment motions or at a trial. So the fact is we've made the allegation. The allegation has to be taken as true. It's not.
And that allegation requires us to presume at this point or to infer that these providers will take that statement as true and won't refer, essentially.
Yes. I'll move on to the tortious interference claim. I want to quickly explain the relationship just to make sure this is clear. I use the word referrals. I think the better word is assist. If you read the provider referral letters. They say the test greatly assists me in treating my patients. That's really what MDL does. This isn't a passing the baton where MDL is treating the patient. The physician needs to know what kind of disease the patient has and how to treat it. They send the test to MDL. MDL does the test and reports back to the physician. That's the business relationship. Also, if we're out of network and if there is a network benefit, then Blue Cross will pay for the charge. If there's not an out-of-network benefit, the patient pays for the charge. So we have business relations with both the physicians and with the patients. The torts, one thing I want to point
out. How is that relationship? So it's interference with that relationship you just described between your client and the physicians. That's the relationship that's interfered with.
Yes, and the patients.
How is that relationship changed by Blue Cross saying, we're not going to pay unless you get authorization?
Well,
how is that relationship changed? It's the same relationship.
It's when you combine all the letters, when you read them all together, the physician says, I have a relationship. I use these people, and their tests assist me. And I want to continue. That's the gravamen of the letter. Blue Cross acknowledges that in the response letter. We understand that you want to, I think they say, you are using or you want to continue using it.
Yeah, but doesn't your argument that type of interference, doesn't that completely implode the right of an insurer to authorize or not authorize a provider?
No, it does not. The problem here is there was a letter written in response. There is a promise made to the provider, separate from the letters. I said there's several things that have to be looked at. There's a promise made by Blue Cross to the providers and to the patients that we will not interfere with the physician's judgment. You exercise your independent medical judgment. Then Blue Cross writes a letter to the doctor and says, we get it that you want to continue to use MDL. You want to continue the business relationship going forward, but you better not, because if you do, we're going to maybe kick you out of the network.
Well,
that's the interference.
Well, saying, you know, you can continue referral, but we're not going to pay unless we authorize. Isn't that what they're saying?
No, they're saying if you go ahead, refer out a network if you want to, but if you do, you might find yourself out of our network, which covers 61% of the private health care business in Oklahoma.
What you're suggesting is essentially they acted unlawfully. That's how they interfered, because they didn't indicate that there could still be authorization. There was no. It was all or none, essentially.
Number one is they broke their promise to the providers and the patients. They said, exercise your medical judgment however you see fit. If you want to refer out a network, do it. But in the same breath, they say, but if you do that, we're going to penalize you. Just wanted to remind you of that.
Sure. The way I understand their argument, though, is, yes, they did make that sort of broad brush statement at the end of the letter, but in the paragraph before that, they have a huge quotation that they remind the providers that they have to seek pre-authorization if they want to use them. So I think their argument is, yeah, maybe our final statement was broad brush, but you should know, based on that paragraph that preceded it, that, of course, there's still, you can seek pre-authorization. Basically, we're not going to give it to you, but.
I'll answer that. I'm down to 1 minute. I want to make one more point. I'll answer your question.
Right.
Could I have just a minute for rebuttal? I'll try to be real
That's
quick.
That's fine.
Yes, they do tell them that you have the right to pre-authorize. They tell them that. But they tell them if you do that, we may kick you out of the network. The second thing is, why in the world would any provider bother to seek pre-authorization and go to that trouble when Blue Cross has already said, in our mind, we're going to deny it because you can already send it to a laboratory? That's the interference with the business relationship. those statements cause the providers to no longer do business with us when they express in their letters that they want to, and when Blue Cross in its letters acknowledges that. The point I wanted to make real quickly is, if you look at the Colmia case that we cite on page 1285 and 1286, 693 F3rd, 1285 and 86, there are two different tests for breach, interference with an existing contractual relationship and interference with a prospective economic advantage. We're going under the latter. The first test requires an element of malice. The second one does not. So that doesn't apply. The district court applied the correct test. We also applied the correct test in our brief. The appellee applies the malice test. It's not applicable here. We have alleged malice specifically using that word in the complaint, but that's not the correct test. And I wanted to make that point. I have.
And the evidence of the existing relationship is basically their own allegation in their letter that some of you are currently using.
Yes,
this lab.
And I believe what they say. Let me find it here and I'll read it. They say.
Well, I have that, and I don't want you to take the time right now.
I'm just saying,
is there any other evidence of the existing relationship other than their own letter suggesting
that? The doctors
that?
Say we have a relationship.
Okay.
In
their
the response
letter plus
Bruce,
this letter.
Blue
okay.
Cross confirms that, and they say they use the word continue. We understand that you either are using or are going to continue using.
All right.
The provider.
Thank you.
So, all right, thank you.
Can you add another minute to their time also?
May it please the court, counsel. I'm William Sheridan. With me at counsel table is Martin Bishop. Together, we represent Appellee Blue Cross. The district court put the bar right where it belongs at the pleading stage under Twombly, Iqbal, and this court's decisions in cases like Robbins and Colic. The factual allegations in the complaint and the letter that you've discussed simply don't push the tort claims at issue here across the line from the realm of the conceivable to the plausible.
Well, you know, if you have a product and you say, my product does everything their product does, aren't you bad-mouthing their product in the sense that you're denying that it does things that this other product does not?
Well, a couple points there. I think that's something you often see in advertising generally, and what you really have there is a comparative statement between the capabilities of two products. To the defamation point, you know, you need a false statement, and you need a statement that lowers the plaintiff in the estimation.
Okay, but they allege a false statement. They allege that's false,
right,
that their product does more. So you have an alleged falsity.
Right. So
why is that falsity, as alleged, not proof, not defamatory?
It's not defamatory because the statement in the letter, it's an issue. And I'd like to come back to whether you need to accept that that's false based on the allegations of the complaint. But in the context of the letter, it says that Blue Cross has verified that the services referenced in the physician recommendation letters are provided by in-network laboratories. Immediately after that, it goes on to say, to discuss your specific testing needs, contact the two in-network labs, and you can discuss the needs of any particular patient. It then says, as Judge Moritz noted, it quotes the contract as saying, if in your medical judgment you determine that a particular patient does need an MDL test, you can do that. You just have to go through the pre-authorization to do so. So,
well, it doesn't say that. Then eventually it says, if you continue to refer your patients to this lab, you're done. You're out of the network, or you may be out of the network. It doesn't say anything about go ahead and give it a try. Try to seek pre-certification or pre-authorization, even though we're not going to give it to you because we just told you these in-network providers have the same services.
Well, I think in the context of the letter, it's stating the contractual obligations, which are there is an opportunity to go out of network. You just have to follow the process. The doctor has to determine that the patient needs it and go through pre-authorization. So I think what the part of the letter you're referring to, Judge Moritz, refers to is if you continue to do this or if you do this without preauthorization, then we may terminate. And so that is an assertion of the contract, right. To the issue of whether you even need to accept that statement is false, I mean, we accept as true that MDL's tests are unique and proprietary. What the letter that Blue Cross wrote really says is we verified that the services, specific services you referenced in the letter, are available on an in-network basis. So there in the Collick case, there was an allegation, as an employment discrimination case, and there was an allegation that the plaintiff was terminated because of her protected status and that the reasons given for her termination were false. This court said there that that was a conclusory allegation that need not be accepted. So we don't necessarily concede that you need to accept that as false. And I think in the context of the letter, the door remains open to find out what the testing needs of a particular patient are and to proceed with the contractually set forth preauthorization process.
Okay, now, but the relationship between the physician provider and the appellant here, they can refer. They just can't get reimbursed by Blue Cross, right? So isn't Blue Cross, by this last statement in the letter, interfering with that relationship? That it's not limited to pre-authorization. It just says, if you continue to refer your patients to out-of-network laboratories, we may terminate your contracts. Well, they can refer, you know, and the patient just has to pay. That sounds like a threat.
No, well, I think that I think you have to read that in the context of the preceding paragraph, which is this is how you do.
Let me just tell you.
Yeah.
Because incorporate this in the answer. Once you say context, you have changed this from a motion to dismiss to a motion for summary judgment.
No, but the context of what's in the record at the motion to dismiss, which is the contractual process for seeking pre-authorization. So Blue Cross, I think there's a very narrow expectancy at issue and a very narrow purported interference, which is to treat Blue Cross members, to refer lab tests for Blue Cross members to the plaintiff without seeking pre-authorization and to have Blue Cross pay for it. I think, Judge Murphy, as you indicated, that would implode the very idea of provider networks. If a doctor says, we generally like these tests, we think we should be able to use them and Blue Cross should pay for them, that circumvents the contractual provider network that Blue Cross has designed to control the cost of healthcare for its patients. So the context is simply what's in the record. I don't think the allegations are that I think the plaintiff acknowledges that the patient is going to pay for it directly, that can do so. Their point is the patients don't want to pay for it directly. Blue Cross should have to pay for it. And underlying all of this, to both the defamation claim and the tortious interference claim, there's an element of damage. And I think what the plaintiff is lacking are factual allegations of how they've actually been harmed here. Plaintiff's counsel pointed to paragraph 62 and 72, saying that the MDL has been harmed by the conduct of Blue Cross. MDL has lost referrals. But those are the exact sort of conclusory, the plaintiff unlawfully harmed me allegations that were rejected.
Well, lost referrals would be damages. I'm not sure what more at this stage you would be asking them to say.
I think we'd be asking to say exactly what the same plaintiff said in the IBC case, which they also rely on. That's the Eastern District of Pennsylvania case, where the tortious interference claim did survive a motion to dismiss. But the factual allegations there were very different. And there they alleged that a letter was sent, but also that the recommending physicians came back to MDL, it's the same plaintiff, and said, we're not going to refer to you anymore because we got this letter that threatened us. And in that case, there were additional allegations. It wasn't just the letter, that payments were going to be cut off. So
you're raising a causation and damages issue. Mm-hmm. Correct my memory, but my memory is that the district court didn't go there. Is my memory wrong?
The district court
went. It has been.
The district court said that, you know, they hadn't alleged a plausible expectancy. I think, you know, to carry on from what plaintiff's counsel argued, you know, I think the district court did say there were insufficient facts. It didn't use those terms, but it, you know, there was not a valid, plausible expectation of a relationship here. And the district court did point out that that plaintiff could refer business, or that business for Blue Cross members could be referred to plaintiff if those members paid for it themselves. So there were factual allegations underlying the defamation and, excuse me, the tortious interference.
But the letter basically says, if you refer, it uses such general language, if you go ahead knowing that we have folks that can do the same thing, it's not unique, if you go ahead and refer, we may boot you out of the network. It doesn't give any qualifications to that, and this is a motion to dismiss.
Right, but I think
you're asking us to essentially, you know, take other parts of the letter and say, well, that's not really what they meant.
Well, I think
that's problematic at the dismissal stage.
I think even at the dismissal stage, you should review the letter. The letter has to be reviewed in context and then in the context of the allegations. And I think consistent with the Morrow Development case, and this goes to the unlawful interference element of the tortious interference claim, under Oklahoma law, under Wilspec and under Brock, you need unlawful activity interfering with the prospective relationship. And if it
would be unlawful, wouldn't it, for you and your relationship at least, or in your contractual relationship, it would be unlawful for Blue Cross to say, you can't even seek pre-authorization. If you refer, we might boot you out of the network. That would be unlawful, wouldn't it?
I don't know that it would be unlawful.
They could threaten, regardless of whether they even seek pre-authorization, which is what they're supposed to do.
Right, and there, to be clear, no allegations that that's actually occurred here. But I don't think there are any allegations to suggest, or any case law to suggest, it would be unlawful to say we will terminate our contractual relationship with you. They're not suggesting they'll do it inconsistently with their contractual.
We'll terminate our contractual relationship even if you abide by it and seek pre-authorization.
Sounds like a refusal to deal to me.
Right, and it may be a refusal to deal, but there's no antitrust allegation here.
Well, you have some horizontal stuff going on here, because you could say the network of doctors is the horizontality that's needed for per se refusal to deal. And when you add the vertical stuff, you know, then maybe that makes it a rule of reason case.
Well, it would be purely vertical because Blue Cross is the payer here, and there's no agreement between competing.
Right, but the network of doctors are a group of independent contractors. That's going down a rabbit hole. I'm sorry.
Can I get you to address the defamation?
Yes, sir.
How is the statement defamatory?
We don't believe it is. As I said before, I don't think it need not be accepted as false under Colic.
Okay, but how about the defamatory part? I mean, maybe I can just ask you to directly address your opposing counsel's argument that this, of course, lowers the company in the estimation of the community because it says it no longer has a unique product that it's offering. How is that not defamatory?
It's not defamatory, Your Honor, because underlying that is speculation and assumption about how the physicians who are receiving the letter are taking it and reading it. And I think what you would need to suggest that it's defamatory are factual allegations that physicians who I think it's fair to say know what tests their patients need, know what services they need to deliver to their patients, assume that to be defamatory. In fact, at page 19, footnote 4 of its opening brief, appellant says it is impossible to tell what physicians now believe. And that's what we believe highlights that those allegations are in the realm of the conceivable rather than the plausible. There are no factual allegations to push that point across the line. Also,
so your argument is, and I think this is what you said in the brief, and I just don't get this, your argument is that we should assume at dismissal stage that not a single one of these 50 providers who received this letter, not a single one of them believed what was said there. That they didn't believe that they could, that they needed to stop referring, or that they did not believe that services were not unique. You want us to do that at dismissal stage.
I think
you want us to assume not a single one would have believed what the letter said.
I think what Robbins and Colick say is that the complaint must plead facts, not conclusions, to allow you to make that inference. And what we are arguing is that there are not sufficient factual allegations to permit the court to make that, to form the basis for that reasonable inference.
Well, what facts might have been pled?
Exactly what was pled in paragraph 78A through 78M of the IBC case in Philadelphia, again, where MDL was the plaintiff. And those are facts that say, but the MDL said, we received a letter, we received contact from a physician that said, we're not going to use your tests anymore. We're going to use the in-network providers. Those are the sorts of facts that we contend push the claim across the line.
But when if we're talking about plausibility, all, I mean, that's an easy test to me. When you combine that with what we were discussing with the language in that last paragraph, isn't it plausible that a doctor would do the very same thing that they did in the other case that they had a letter about? It's plausible that's going to occur, isn't it?
I think it's conceivable, but that you need additional factual allegations to make it plausible.
The plausibility is the inference plausible? And the inference is we're going to quit sending you stuff.
I think what Iqbal says is the inference has to be reasonable. The claims have to be plausible. And I don't think it's necessarily, and I think what Iqbal and Robin and Colick also say is that if a complaint's facts encompass lawful as well as unlawful conduct and multiple inferences can be drawn, you don't push the claim across the line to the plausible. And I think here there may be perfectly benign reasons why a recommending physician, the physicians that wrote those letters, haven't referred tests to MDL. And there are no allegations to say we've lost referrals because of this letter. Counsel now says that they have that evidence. They didn't plead it. They said that he also said that they pled everything they had. I see that I'm running low on time. I want to make sure on the defamation point that I add, this is not libel per se as pled. Libel per se requires a statement that can only have one meaning, an opprobrious one. And I looked that up in the dictionary. It's accusing the plaintiff of extremely shameful or disgraceful conduct. I think on its face that's not the case here. And so without libel per se, you need special damages to sustain a defamation claim. And what the Sturgeon case in the Oklahoma Supreme Court says is it's not even sufficient to say the plaintiff unlawfully harmed me in a certain pecuniary amount, which this plaintiff hasn't even done. You must also say how that harm was occasioned. I think to do so, you'd need the allegations that they pled in the IBC case.
Was that part of the district court's decision, that approach?
I don't know that the district court got to the damages, but it's certainly a grounds for affirmance, and we ask that you affirm. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we're out of time. Oh, I said you could have another. Did I give you a minute? I can't remember. I think I did say that, didn't I? Yeah. Sorry. No, I apologize. Yeah. We talked about that.
I'll just make four real quick responses. Number one is, we're talking about the threat of termination in the letter as being an interference with business relationships. I want to again stress the futility point. When Blue Cross says, we've already made up our minds that there's nothing special about this testing, it means seek pre-authorization all you want. We're going to deny it because there's no reason for us to grant it. That interferes with the business relations as well. My second point is, my opponent talked about circumventing the network. The network exists to contain costs. The problem is the doctors are told you can refer out of network. If you have a cancer patient, send them to Mayo Clinic, send them to MD Anderson. But if they say there's nothing special about those clinics and if you do refer, we may kick you out of the network, that's a problem. Third is damages. You know, my understanding is we can plead damages under notice pleading. We said in paragraph 72, as a result of CFC's defamatory statements, MDL has lost physician referrals. and has had to otherwise find accommodations to address physician concerns. If we do need to plead those additional things that are in the other MDL complaint, which I don't think we have to do, they did it, but I don't think we have to do it, that's when we should be given leave to amend. Again, I don't think we have to plead that kind of detail. I could attach my chart. I could tell the number of physician referrals that have dropped off, but I don't think we have to do that at the pleading stage. If I'm wrong, that's when we request leave to amend.
We need to finish up.
Okay, I'm finished. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. And we'll take your case under advisement. Thank you.